Order in the court! This is the Pop-matic podcast for November 5th. I object!
Overrule.
This is the Pop-matic podcast, where you can rock out with your library card out. I'm Brian, and joining me today are...
Crystal.
Mike.
Bill.
Amanda.
Why do I object? Because today's show is legal thrillers that shock in the courtroom.
Dun dun.
Why do I object to legal thrillers? No, I'm sorry. I mean, why legal thrillers today? Because Scott Turow is this year's Nashville Public Library Literary Award winner. Say that three times fast.
Three times fast.
Mr. Turow is best known for his legal thrillers. And if you want to see him in person, come down to a free public talk at Montgomery Bell Academy, Saturday, November 8th at 10 a.m. Or, if you got the coin and a good suit and you want to get up close and personal with Scott Turow and ensure the future of the library in the process, you can go to the Fancy Gala. That costs more money, not free. But stay tuned. During the Tickle My Fancy segment, there will be a big announcement.
Don't want to miss it.
Teaser. Amanda, what is thrilling you legally?
So I don't think that, you know, you can talk about legal thrillers and, you know, not talk about John Grisham. And so I'm going to talk, wait, what? No. So I would say that no one who watches my other choice for this week's podcast would ever argue that it was a, finger quotes, legal thriller. But most of them would probably admit that at least portions of it are thrilling, like maybe the time the main character is dressed up like Tears for Fears and Michael Jackson. And it's about the Santa Barbara Police Department, so, you know, that technically makes it legal. And of course, I'm talking about the late, great TV show, Psych! Basic premise, Sean Spencer, played by James Rhodey, I guess is how you say his name, has super observational powers that often put him in the middle of precarious crime situations. In order to keep himself out of trouble, he has to put his hand to his head and invent a story that he's the psychic detective. And his best friend, Chubbs McGee, a.k.a. Burton Guster, a.k.a. Gus, a.k.a. Dulé Hill, helps out along the way. Psych ran for 8 seasons on USA. It was on from 2006 to... It just finished up in 2014. And I didn't really get into it until I started checking out the DVDs from the library, and I think I did that because I liked Dulé Hill on the West Wing so much. It's witty, it's well-written, and despite the fact that the premise completely shouldn't work and it probably should have been canceled in the first season, it does because it's hilarious. It also has some great 80s references and quips, which may be why it's so appealing to Mama Generation. Even though, and I haven't finished all 8 seasons yet, I'm almost done with 7, so if you know what's going on, don't, if you know how it ends, don't tell me, I don't, no spoiler alerts. But I love Psych, and would probably watch it all day if possible, and I just found out that the library has a handful of Psych novels with great titles like A Fatal Frame of Mind and Mind Altering Murder. They're in ebook form on our Overdrive system, and they're all written by William Rabkin. I just started one last night because I just found them yesterday, so I haven't read a complete one yet, but so far it's pretty good, and I'm going to try to explore these and see if they're as good as the show. And there's also, I'm excited about this, there's also Psych's Guide to Crime Fighting for the Totally Unqualified by Chad Jervich that NPL does not own, but I have diligently requested this from the Interlibrary Loan and will report back on its awesomeness or lack thereof. So if you like your legal thrillers more comedic than dangerous, Psych is definitely the place you need to be. But I bet you already knew I was going to say that. Mr. Bill.
Perry Mason sat at the big desk. There was about him the attitude of one who is waiting. His face in repose was like the face of a chess player who is studying the board. That face seldom changed expression. He gave the impression of being a thinker and a fighter, a man who could work with infinite patience to jockey an adversary into the right position, and then... finish him with one punch. Wow.
Yeah.
What an opener. That was from the very first Perry Mason mystery written in 1933 by Earl Stanley Gardner, entitled The Case of the Velvet Claws. Perry Mason is like Sherlock Holmes, Tarzan, or James Bond, a literary character that if you mention his name, you would know who we were talking about. Earl Stanley Gardner was a lawyer himself, but became bored with the law and started to write for Pulp Magazine on the side. Mr. Gardner wrote about 80 Perry Mason books, and we have a nice collection in our system. We also have the television show, which ran for 9 seasons on CBS, that starred Raymond Burr. So now would be a good time to get associated with this cultural icon. Crystal?
All right. I have 2 legal thrillers to recommend. Here goes number 1. At the risk of becoming like Brian and his Philip K. Dick references, it is with slight hesitation I bring yet another David Tennant project to the table. But I'd be remiss if I didn't recommend the miniseries The Escape Artist. It debuted on BBC in 2013 and was featured as part of the 2014 Masterpiece Mystery season, hosted, of course, by the awesome Alan Cumming. So David plays Barrister Will Burton, a cocky defense lawyer who has yet to lose a case. Will takes on a real psychopath as a client and manages to get Mr. Psychopath acquitted for a brutal murder. You know that old folk tale about snakes? Well, Will finds out the hard way he should never have taken on a psychopath. This miniseries has it all. Authentic courtroom scenes, dramatic tension, edge-of-your-seat suspense, shirtless David Tennant. I jest, but this miniseries is so well done. Think of the better Law & Order episodes you've watched and multiply your viewing satisfaction by 50 million. And you get...
I don't do math. That
sounds
infinite
subjective.
Jest. I just have this infinite jest moment.
That's right. But seriously, this miniseries is brilliant. The Escape Artist.
Isn't he in the new... Isn't there a new legal thing that he's in that's like Grace...
Broadchurch.
Well, yeah, no. Broadchurch was another BBC series that he was in. And then Fox took that same concept and then... remade it for American TV, and David Tennant is again playing the main character.
So I've seen commercials for it. But
I'm not sure if it's going to last out or not. I've heard.
How's his American accent?
You know, I've only watched one episode, but he's a great actor, so he was pulling it off pretty well, I have to say.
It's just 10 episodes, so they'll probably.
They'll go ahead and air.
Yeah, have to.
So my second choice. Because I remember, I told you I have 2. My second choice is a novel. It's by William Landay, and it's called Defending Jacob. It's similar to Thoreau's Presumed Innocent in that it's written in the first person, and the central character is a prosecuting attorney. Andy Barber, he's a senior prosecutor, devoted husband, and father of a 14-year-old son. Barber and his family live in a quiet, upscale neighborhood. Everything is perfect in Andy's life until one of his son's classmates is found dead in the woods near their home. At first, Barber leads the investigation, but a major conflict arises when Barber's own son, Jacob, is charged with the murder. The novel goes back and forth from the courtroom to the growing strains on Andy's family to how Andy's own dark past may play a part. If you're looking for a great legal thriller for a book discussion group, you won't go wrong with Defending Jacob. All right, Mike, the jury's out.
Oh, well then, now time for my deliberations.
That's right.
Because today, I'd like to talk about my favorite legal drama, a movie I keep debating every time it comes on, every time Criterion has one of their Blu-ray sales, 12 Angry Men, from 1957. Directed by Sidney Lumet or Lumet?
Lumet.
It is essentially an entire film about a jury deliberation during a murder trial. A young Hispanic man from a poor neighborhood has been accused of murdering his father with a switchblade. And at the beginning, it appears to be an open and shut case. I mean, they kind of whip out this pretty, clear-cut evidence that he did it. And most of the jurors are just looking forward to just saying guilty and going home. But Henry Fonda, juror number 8, is convinced of the kid's innocence and spends most of the film trying to convince his fellow jurors. It's based on a play by a guy named Reginald Rose, and really shows it. With the exception of the very beginning, where the judge confers with the jury, the entire film takes place in one hot, steamy room with this itty-bitty fan, and I think breaks halfway through, too. One of the big appeals of it to me is like really the acting. It's a very, actor's movie. And it's got some of the greatest character actors of the 1950s. I mean, Martin Balsam, Lee J. Cobb, E.G. Marshall, Jack Klugman, Ed Begley Sr., And John Fiedler, the voice of Piglet. Every time he talks, I'm like, oh, it's Piglet. He's like totes adorbs. You know, even in person, he's like, you know, you want to hug him. All of their individual personalities and prejudices and tics are shown throughout the course of the film. Rose meant it more to be more of a than just a tale of a jury trial. It's more of a comment on society as a whole. If you actually read the play, which you have to use IL because we don't have it, Dramatis Personae at the beginning gives a very detailed description of each juror's personality, and they basically all range from unflattering to vile. You know, except for juror number 8, you know, the Henry Fonda character, who is a good saintly person who stands up for himself and stands by his convictions. Even juror number 2, the aforementioned Piglet, whom I liked a lot because he's Piglet, was based... And based, you know, on the film, he's, you know, I considered him to be the only other good juror. In the play, he's said to be a spineless follower who only goes with number 8 because he has a stronger personality. Go figure. So, you know, tense legalese drama. Yeah. All right. Pass it to you, Brian.
You know, often I hear you guys say, this was a hard one for me. I don't know what to do. This is actually a really hard one for me. As has been mentioned in the podcast before, I always relate to the killer. So the legal thrillers, they don't matter to me, right? I mean, I don't want there to be a guilty verdict, and I don't care who did it because I know that I did. But the,
you do look like one.
But the thing that kept coming back to me was this idea of like the Fourth Estate or like the press as sort of muckraking truth teller, and then that opened up a whole bunch of options that I could have went with. I decided to go with We Steal Secrets, the story of WikiLeaks, and the title says it all. It is the story of WikiLeaks. And if you don't think it's thrilling, you definitely should watch the movie. It has a 93% approval rating on Rotten Tomatoes. That's, like, extremely good.
I too think it's good. Objection.
Disclosures like these tear at the fabric of responsible government.
We're looking at all of the things that we can do to stem the flow of this information.
This was the biggest leak in the history of this particular planet.
My name is Julian Assange. I'm the editor of WikiLeaks.
We help you get the truth out. If you get this material, give it to us, no questions asked, and you'll help change history.
The internet lets governments get more information than ever, but it lets citizens do the same.
Here was this kid who had reached out in confidence and said, hey, I'm leaking secrets.
Consequences of the release of these documents are potentially severe and dangerous.
The Army has detained a U.S. soldier in connection with the leak of this classified video.
Two of the men killed worked for the Reuters news agency.
Journalists' cameras were mistaken for weapons.
The prime suspect is 22-year-old Bradley Manning.
There is a responsibility to the needs of the many.
We promised the source that we would publish everything.
About 1 o'clock in the morning, I took delivery on a USB stick of 390,000 secret US military records.
There was material which could get people hurt. Julian said, if an Afghan civilian helps occupying forces, he deserves to die.
They might already have on their hands the blood of some young soldier.
Scared the hell out of a lot of people. How are we going to stop it? And how far has it gone already?
The sort of aging student hobo was a rock star, changing phones and changing computers,
wearing a bulletproof vest.
He'd been trained in evasive tactics.
This idealist became something else.
I'm untouchable now in this country.
Sweden issued a warrant for the arrest of Julian Assange
on suspicion of molestation and rape.
I really didn't want this to be in the papers.
I have never said that this is a honey trap. I have never said that it is not a honey trap.
Everyone has secrets. If they are broadly known, you cannot accomplish your work.
I'm not going to talk about that.
But it does affect WikiLeaks.
I may be very candid. Nation states need to be secret in order to be successful. We steal secrets.
It's not about WikiLeaks. It's about transparency. Who gets to control information?
Truth is always stranger than fiction, and I think there's a lot of backstory to WikiLeaks that a lot of people don't know, like what happened in Iceland and why the people in WikiLeaks are heroes in Iceland. And it goes into details also about the charges, the sexual assault charges against Julian Assange. Those are usually, you always hear that drop, but they never actually go into the details of the case, what that's about. So they go into that in detail. And director Alex Gibney, he builds this arc, this narrative arc by comparing the rise of Julian Assange's fame, but then I think also like sort of the mental breakdown of Chelsea Manning. That's how he structures the...
It's very clever, I thought.
Yeah, how he structures the movie. And it's actually, I mean, as far as the well-constructed documentary, it's really excellent. And Alex Gibney definitely falls into this sort of fourth estate idea of the press. He's made films like Taxi to the Dark Side, Client 9, Casino Jack, The Armstrong Lie, which is actually really funny because he was going to do a straight documentary about Lance Armstrong, and then in the middle of filming, like, Lance Armstrong admitted that he had doped all his years when he won all his races. So the film changed a little bit.
Just slightly.
So, definitely in this movie, I think Gibney does take sides, and Julian Assange wears the black hat and Chelsea Manning wears the white hat. Now, Assange and WikiLeaks didn't like that, so they issued a rebuttal. Their rebuttal was a transcript of the movie, and then like bullet points for everything that they thought was wrong. I'll put a link to WikiLeaks rebuttal too. We Steal Secrets, the story of WikiLeaks, a really great, moving, dramatic documentary.
It's nice getting the background of Assange because, you know, he just kind of appeared. It's kind of nice, like, seeing, like, you know, what his early life was like, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
So I did find it a little odd that Manning's emails were, it was narrated. They were typed out on the screen and narrated at the same time by, like, a computer, I think, and it was distracting. I didn't like that.
Maybe it was Stephen Hawking.
In scenes like that, that's actually what you see when you actually see, like, the hand of the director.
Yeah.
And that's the thing that a lot of people don't realize about documentary is even if the director says that they're neutral, they're not neutral. Manning's chat logs, he absolutely uses those to construct the story that he wants, and he takes them out of context and puts them on the screen as if he's writing a script to a movie.
Yeah.
And you know what I mean? So I think when you watch any documentary, you have to be aware about that kind of thing.
We have a documentary on documentaries that I checked out recently, which I don't remember the title of now. You can correct me in the next episode. but it goes into, like, you know, how you craft a documentary and, you know, what kind of prejudices you bring to that. And that old story about how Werner Herzog, in one of his, he staged a scene that made it more dramatic about the main person's mental state.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it, you know, it's a lie. He faked it. So, you know, the ethics of that was ostensibly a nonfiction film.
Okay, this is Tickle My Fancy, where we're talking about things that are happening in pop culture. Maybe the library owns them. Maybe you can get them from the library. Maybe you can't. Stuff that's going on. Now, the one thing that's going on in Pop-matic world is that the one and only Jeremy Estes is back.
Pop-matic.
On the Pop-matic podcast.
We missed you.
Thanks.
Thanks, guys.
That was your intro.
That was your intro.
Okay, that's all I got.
That's what you waited an hour to hear. So,
Jeremy's back.
But Amanda.
Okay.
What's tickling your fancy besides Jeremy being back?
Well, I'm excited about what was tickling Jeremy's fancy. But I always love discovering new music, whether on purpose or by accident. And so the other day I was listening to the Quirk playlist on Spotify, and this really antiquated remake of Blurred Lines came on, and I kind of stopped what I was doing and went, wow, that's cool.
What I'm trying to say, if you can read from the same page, maybe I'm going deaf, maybe I'm going blind, maybe I'm out of my mind. Okay, now he was close, tried to domesticate ya.
So, and I wanted to check out who is this? What's going on? And so the group is called Postmodern Jukebop, and they make a living covering popular tunes in old styles, anything from like 1920s pop to 50s girl groups to 60s R&B. It was founded by Scott Bradley, Bradlee, in 2013, and he first had gained some notoriety on YouTube for doing, for lack of a better term, jazzy arrangements of popular songs. They have several albums out. On the album Historical Misappropriation, they cover All About That Bass, which I've talked about before. That's really kind of an awesome cover, and it sounds like it was played on a player piano, which you wouldn't think would work with that song, but it really does. My favorite album title they have is called Clubbin' with Grandpa. It includes a cover of Careless Whisper, which features the saxophonist Dave Koz, and they do a brief visit to Dave Brubeck's Take 5. And they also cover Fancy, which we've talked about. And if you've ever wanted to do the Charleston to talk dirty to me, this is going to be your shot, because they cover that one as well.
That's been my dream.
I knew that was just for you, Jeremy. So, unfortunately, the library does not own any postmodern jukebox in any form. But if you have Spotify, or you can look them up online, they are definitely worth a listen, and they just might tickle your fancy as well. All right, Mr. Bill.
Well, tickling my fancy is Movies at Main. Just giving everybody a heads up, because on Saturday, November 15th, 2014, at 2 p.m. at the Main Library downtown, we are going to show Juggernaut. Now, what's it about? Well, I'll simply read the tagline. You will pay me $1.5 million by dawn, or the world's greatest luxury liner will rip open like a can of sardines, and 1,200 men, women, children will die. Good day, Juggernaut. So, it's not a romantic comedy. Juggernaut stars Richard Harris, Omar Sharif, David Hemmings, and once again, it'll be showing Saturday, November 2014 at 2 p.m. at the Downtown Public Library, and it's free.
Woohoo!
Mike.
Well, that's an episode of The Love Boat I would totally watch. So, I thought I'd talk about my favorite podcast that I'm not on. Doug Loves Movies is having a taping at Zanies.
What's the title?
Doug Loves Movies.
Okay, that's not what I thought you said. I thought you said Doug Loves Boobies.
Wow.
Fair enough.
Doug Loves Movies is having a taping at Zanies at 4:20 on November 8th. If you haven't listened to it, every episode basically goes like this. Stoner comedian Doug Benson has a chat with three or more other comedians, usually about movies, but it can be about anything else. Perhaps a Mark Wahlberg impersonator will pop in and give some lines. Then they play some movie-related games, ending with my favorite, the Leonard Maltin game, which is astonishingly complicated and it took me two episodes to figure out. But now it's pretty exciting because, like, every Christmas vacation, I like driving back home and listening to the special 12 Guests of Christmas and screaming in my car, negative two names. Good times. If you listen to it, you'll have a good time. I've trudged out to the last two and had a great time. Last year, I got a picture with Doug Benson and got his autograph too. Good times.
Who's gonna be the guest?
He usually doesn't announce it in advance, but my guess is that I think his name's Henry Lee is probably gonna be one of them because he's also doing something there. We'll find out.
But isn't he the guy that's on that Chris Hardwick show?
Yes.
A lot.
Yeah.
He never wins. He just. Okay. So I know who you're talking about now.
Yeah. He has a very pun-based sense of humor, which clearly goes into my wheelhouse. Oh, boy. What have you got today, Jeremy?
I'm tickled to be back amongst y'all. But I have never been a big fan of heavy metal because I knew this kid that he would always smoke cigarettes before school when we were in eighth grade, and he wrote poems about hating his mom and made swastikas with paperclips.
Yes.
And,
nice
and,
guy.
Yeah, super, super good. He punched a friend of mine in the face once. But he was a nice enough guy. But it was always Metallica, Metallica, Metallica. And this was like around the time of Enter Sandman. I enjoyed that stuff at the time, but it was also because of that guy. And I was also afraid of being like him, I think, that I sort of avoided it. But I recently bought a really cheap copy of their third album, Master of Puppets. And I paid like $1 for it, and it kind of rules, and it really grew on me. And so I was interested in this portion of their career, their early years. And so I downloaded from Overdrive the book Birth School Metallica Death by Paul Branigan and Ian Winwood. And it's really a cool book. It sort of details their rise, their early years getting together, and focuses a lot on James Hetfield and Lars Ulrich because they were kind of the driving force behind the band. Especially in the early years, Lars was telling people that they had a band before they even did have a band. And then they're sort of the sort of slow rise to the top, building their career one album at a time. And then, of course, the tragic death of Cliff Burton. And, you know, it sort of is filled with the kind of usual rock and roll cliches of drunken debauchery. But the book is really funny because it sort of pokes fun at how inept they were, especially early on. Lars wasn't really a good drummer, and then also they were all just kind of doofuses, like in jeans and smelled bad. It's really interesting because now the way that people think of them is sort of completely different than the way that they were then. This book ends in 1994 just as their Black album is being released, which features Enter Sandman, and it kind of ends really abruptly, but it sort of makes sense given how meteoric their rise was after the release of that album. What little I've listened to them since discovering Master of Puppets 30 years after it was released is that I think I might have thought that they were sellouts in 1991.
Yeah, when they cut their hair is when, you know, they're suddenly selling out.
But there's a lot of, like, that Black album was produced by a guy that produced Bon Jovi. And, like, I can kind of hear some of that in Inner Sandman and stuff. It's a lot different than...
There's a definite difference between the earlier stuff where every song is about 7 or 8 minutes
long. Yeah, and then
the Black Album where every song is radio friendly.
It's pretty radio friendly. It's really incredible. Like I mean, I knew people that had always liked them. And
well, Ride the Lightning is amazing.
I have it on hold right now. And I spent an entire evening at home alone looking up Cliff Burton bass solos on YouTube and listening to Venom and all these other new wave of British heavy metal bands.
Yeah.
And
it's, well, they kind of died when Cliff Burton did.
Oh. Well, that's, you know, hey, I think that I might be in that camp, a Cliff of all.
Yeah, yeah.
My former coworker, Chad, is a longtime metal person, and he was talking to me about And Justice for All, and how there's virtually no bass on it. Like they deliberately mixed it low, and you know, in the book they talk about that, and the producer said that Jason Newsted's bass parts are really great. They just aren't there, and that's really interesting.
Yeah, I played Guitar Hero Metallica.
Yeah,
and the bass I played it as the guitar parts, and the bass is just like I can't hear any of this. Isn't fun. I'm just kind of there. But then if I just hold it still, I still can't hear anything and I lose.
I think we've just heard the beginnings of an offshoot podcast, right?
That's right. Blacken.
Metallica.
Metallica.
So what do you think?
Yeah, brother.
Yeah.
It would be Mike singing Metallica all day.
Never free, never mere.
Oh, man.
So I dubbed the unforgivable. No. All right, well.
Here's a crown king of the era.
Crystal! Crystal! Crystal, the podcast you're telling me.
Crystal right there.
Crystal, you like Metallica, right?
Yeah, I do. But now for something completely different.
You're going to talk about unicorns and rainbows.
That's right. The Carpenters.
So, tickling my fancy this week is Jim Carrey's return to Saturday Night Live. Of course, you all have heard me talk about Saturday Night Live before and how, even though I keep watching, you know, it's not very funny. But I think this episode with Jim Carrey as host, Iggy Azalea as a musical guest, that was pretty funny, y'all. I laughed consistently throughout the whole episode, but the Office costume contest sketch had me laughing so hard I scared my cat. She ran out of the room in fear. So there was a cameo by Lorne Michaels and Iggy Azalea, and Sia's chandelier plays a major part of the sketch. So go online, you can watch the whole episode, or at least watch that sketch. Okay. And Adi Bryant gets MVP for her line, "I'm just a woman trying her best."
I like her a lot. I really like, I only watched a little bit of that, but the Carrey family reunion I thought was like a good concept, you know, and playing off all the characters from his movies. And I also really liked the Paul and I was trying to describe that to my wife, and I was like, I can't tell you why that was funny.
Well, you've forgotten the Matthew McConaughey. Which has got like outright 1 million hits over, you know, on YouTube.
Yeah, I felt the same way. Like I tried. I was excited about watching it this year because I'd seen some really good ones last year, especially that doing my Twin Bed song and like some of the. And I liked a lot of the new. I really liked Adi Bryant a lot. The first episode kind of left me cold, except for the He-Man Lion-O skit where they come alive. Mm-hmm. And that was pretty funny because I had those toys, I guess.
Chris Rock hosts Prince's musical guest.
Yeah.
We'll have to talk about that on the next episode.
We'll be in space.
Brian.
So hey, Prince is from so that's space. Okay.
All right. I went to GMX over the weekend, which is a little fan con here, and it's always a lot of fun. One of the people that was there was Teal Shearer. She was one of the guests. And when the Guild ended, the web show that I talked about before, a lot of people like really wanted a Guild spinoff. There were a lot of colorful characters. And there isn't really a proper Guild spinoff, but there sort of is. Because Teal Shearer, who was from the Guild, went on to start her own show called My Gimpy Life. So who was Teal on the guild? Teal was the mean girl in the wheelchair in the Axis of Anarchy. She starts her own show called My Gimpy Life because it's about her life being an actress in a wheelchair. And there's been two seasons so far, and they're really funny. And sometimes it's really serious because it is about her, like, living with her disability, and sometimes it's really funny. And it's like the guild. It's like there's two seasons, but actually if you watch them, like, one season is like 20 minutes, you know, if you watch them all together, and there's like one narrative arc. And I'm going to link to the beginning of the second season because I think actually it's funnier and the ending is like way more emotional and like really punchy in the gut. It's really good. And Teal lives here in Nashville. And I think she's actually putting acting on hiatus while she has a baby. But I got to meet her over the weekend, and My Gimpy Life is an awesome show if you haven't watched it before. And one of the things with My Gimpy Life that kind of happens is it kind of gets targeted at the sort of really specific audience of, like, people who are disabled. Or she said that she does a lot of, like, live Skype sessions with, like, classes about representations, disability in media and stuff. And it actually probably deserves a wider audience than just that. So My Gimpy Life by Teal Shear is freaking good. Corrections!
Objection!
Any corrections on last week's episode?
I wasn't here, so it was correct.
No counselor.
Freudian slip.
I'm not dead.
So. No corrections other than the stuff that was wrong. Mostly nitpicky stuff. Bill, you said the book was called The World of Charles Adams.
Yeah.
It's The World of Chaz Adams. That was his nickname.
Oh, man.
Way to go,
so,
Chaz.
So, Chaz is much douchier. So,
oh, yeah.
Seriously.
So, are you kidding me?
I'm going to...
Oh, it's Bill the Rage. Wait. This episode may end in murder as well.
I'm going to turn the spotlight on myself as well. The Youth Code song, I said the title of the song was Tired Mask. The title of the song is actually Carried Mask. That's me and Bill are just going to start a podcast where we say the wrong things, and other people have to try to figure out what we're talking about.
Cool.
So,
the Long Mall Show.
And we're probably the worst. So,
Freudian slips.
The version of Tunnel of Love at the very beginning of Only Lovers...
Funnel.
Funnel, yes, I'm yes. sorry. The fun...
Wow.
Corrections on a
correction. Corrections on a correction.
Correction.
Which actually makes it a lot funner, in my opinion.
Correction!
But it's called, but the title is Funnel of Love. The version at the very beginning is by a band called Squirrel, spelled all caps, S-Q-U-O-M-G-L-O-T-R-L.
Which is Jim
Jarmusch's band, with vocals by someone named Madeline Folan doing her best Wanda Jackson impression. And then it segues into...
The original...
Segway.
I thought it was the new hip abbreviation.
Guten Tag, mein Name ist Sieg.
I'm going to go on record that I think that I, in that case, I used the word Sieg correctly.
What is the
nine?
Word? I don't know.
Das ist Segway.
It's
Sieg. I'm going to start using it now. That's going to be the new buzzword for the podcast. That's Sieg to
the
crystal.
The all Sieg edition.
I have used this word many times.
Was it
accompanied by laughing?
I don't know.
It is
now.
Why don't my friends giggle when I say
Sieg? Scion and like refuses to call it anything. But.
In music, a Sieg is direction to the performer. It means continue to the next section without pause.
Okay, so I've always pronounced it. Yeah, Sieg. Segway.
Segway.
Sieg.
How's it spelled?
Yeah.
S-E-G-U-E.
Yeah.
Segway. Yeah.
Segway. Is there a pronunciation button?
Yeah, there's a pronunciation thing in.
I've never heard it pronounced Sieg.
Nope.
I've heard Tarzan pronounced Tarzan before.
So wait, no. Wait. I'm going to do a total 180 here. I'm not going to admit that I was wrong. I'm going to admit that I was ignorant of the pronunciation, and I did not understand that you guys were correcting my pronunciation.
Oh, I see.
Oh.
So,
okay.
Yes.
Okay.
So, so you guys were right, and like I don't know if the mic will pick this up.
Hear it.
So, but
this may be my favorite segment of all time.
Segway.
Oh! All right.
Well, well.
If it makes you feel better, I learned that you say instead of tome, like a big fat book is a tome. Mm. I thought it was tomb. And I learned that because of the podcast.
You know,
it's Julie. Right?
It's Julie.
My ego is very thick. It can take many bars. So, okay.
It's bars.
So it segues into the real Wanda Jackson version of Tunnel of Love.
Yeah. Well, I was just so mesmerized by Tilda and
Tom. Popmatic devotees, if they listened to the very end of the episode, they could hear the difference. So, and then I made, besides my mispronunciations, I am really the chillest librarian on earth when it comes to grammar and usage and things like that, right? I'm just whatever. And I think that our podcast is funner if we're cool. Did you get that?
Okay. That's not cool.
But I made the one grammar mistake that I cannot stand. It just like bugs me. Is I said jealousy when I meant envy. Like that's the one mistake that like, bothers me. And does anyone want to explain the difference?
Envious of Amanda's wonderful talent.
That yes.
And jealousy is the negative, and it is more positive.
Jealousy is when you want to like, sort of like keep something to yourself, but it's usually in regards to people.
Sure.
So like if Amanda started playing D&D with my D&D group, like her husband would be kind of jealous.
He would totally be jealous.
Yes, exactly. He'd be at home like, really jealous.
Yeah.
So where envy just means you want something that you don't have.
So I'm envious of Crystal's awesome tie.
Yes.
Yes, you cannot see it, but...
And spiders.
Yeah.
And skulls.
And spider webs. Very cool. Right.
For more information, you can go to
www.library.nashville.org.
O-R-G.
That's the secret.
Segway, man. Segway. Segway.
I
said it quickly.
Oh, wow.
O-R-G.
That's the secret website. Password is Kubrick.
Everyone loves the library.
The word is.
Yeah, that's right. The pubic
library. The
libraries.
Word is. O-R-G.
Segway. Org. Like, Segway. Like organization. And our theme music is by...
Adam Dean.
Hey, next week it's all about space as we celebrate the release of Interstellar.
The Final Frontier.
Sometimes you gotta go back to actually move forward. And I don't mean go back and reminisce or chase ghosts. I mean take a big step back. Like go from winning an Oscar to doing a car commercial. My agent was like, I could understand if you did this right after the Lincoln Lawyer. That would have made sense. But you don't buy a Lincoln because it makes sense. You do it because you love it, or because you're an Uber driver. I feel safe in here to drive around all night long, contemplating the important questions of life. Who am I? Why am I here? When I'm done rolling up this booger, should I eat it or throw it out the window? Feels good. Like a tiny little tennis ball. Hi there, little fella.